the tailgate and walked forward.
5,000 D-mark for this, eh? Istvan asked.
That is correct, Hudson agreed.
I should ask more, but I am not a greedy man.
You are a trusted comrade, my friend, Hudson assured him, briefly wishing that he had a pistol in his belt. The Volvo's big diesel lit up with a rumbling roar, and the truck jerked off, back to the main road, with Yanni at the large, almost flat steering wheel. It didn't take long. And that was a good thing for Ryan, crouching in the cardboard box in the back. He could only guess how the Russians felt, like unborn babies in a horrible womb, one with loaded guns outside it. Ryan was afraid even to smoke a final cigarette, fearing someone might smell the smoke over the pungent diesel exhaust, which was altogether unlikely.
"So, Istvan," Hudson asked in the cab, "what is the routine?"
"Watch. We usually travel at night. Is more dramatic, you say? I know the Hatar Rosheg here many years now. Captain Budai Laszlo is good man to do business with. He has wife and little daughter. Always want present for daughter Zoka."
"I have," Kovach promised, holding up a paper bag.
The border post was sufficiently well-lighted that they could see it 3 kilometers off, and blessedly there was little traffic this time of night. Yanni drove up normally, slowing and stopping there when the private of the border guards, the Hatar Rozheg, waved for them to halt.
"Is Captain Budai here?" Kovach asked at once. "I have something for him."
The private headed into the guardhouse and returned instantly with a more senior man.
"Laszlo, how are you this cold night?" Kovach called in Magyar, then jumped down from the cab with the paper shopping bag.
"Istvan, what can I say? It is dull night," the youngish captain replied.
"And your little Zoka, she is well?"
"Her birthday is next week. She will be 5.
"Excellent," the smuggler observed. He handed over the bag. "Give her these."
These were a pair of candy apple red Reebok sneakers with Velcro closures.
"Lovely," Captain Budai observed with genuine pleasure.
He took them out to look at them in the light. Any female child in the world loved the things, and Laszlo was as happy as his daughter would be in 4 days.
"You are a good friend, Istvan. So what do you transport tonight?"
"Nothing of value. I'm making a pickup this morning in Bogrado.
Anything you need?"
"My wife would love some tapes for the Walkman you got her last month."
The amazing thing about Budai was that he was not an overly greedy man. That was one of the reasons Kovach liked to travel across the border on his watch.
"What groups?"
"The BGs, I think she called them. For me, some show tunes, if you don't mind."
"Anything in particular? The music from American movies, like Star Wars, perhaps?"
"I have that one, but not the new one. The Empire Attacks Back, perhaps."
"Done."
They shook hands.
"How about some Western coffee?"
"What kind?"
"Austrian or American, maybe. There's a place in Bograd that has American Folgers coffee. It is very tasty," Kovach assured him.
"I have never tried that."
"I'll get you some, and you can try it. No charge."
"You are a good man," Budai observed.
"Have a good night."
"Pass," he concluded, waving to his corporal. And it was just that easy. Kovach walked back around and climbed into his truck. He wouldn't have to part with the present he had for Sergeant Kerekesh Mihai, and that was good, too. Hudson was surprised.
"No paper check."
"Laszlo just runs the name through the teletype to Budapest. Some people there are also on my payroll. They are more greedy than he is, but is not major expense." "Yanni, go," he said to the driver, who started up and pulled across the line painted on the pavement.
And just that easily, the truck left the Warsaw Pact.
In the back, Ryan had rarely felt so good to feel a vehicle start to move. It stopped again in a minute, but this was a different border. And going into Yugoslavia, Yanni handled it, just trading a few words with the guard, not even killing the engine, before being waved forward and into the semi-communist country. He drove 3 kilometers before being told to pull off onto a side road. There, after a few bumps, the Volvo stopped. Yugoslavian border security, Hudson saw, was sawed all. Ryan was already out of his cardboard box and standing at the back when the canvas cover was flipped aside. "We are here, Jack," Hudson said. "Where is that exactly?" "Yugoslavia, my lad. The nearest town is Legrad, and here we part company." "Oh?" "Yes, I'm turning you over to Vic Lucas. He's my counterpart in Belgrade." "Vic?" Hudson beckoned. The man who came into view might have been Hudson's twin, except for the hair, which was black. He was also 2 or 3 inches taller, Jack decided on second inspection. He went forward to get the rabbits out of the boxes. That happened in a hurry, and Ryan helped them down, handing the little girl, remarkably still asleep, to her mother, who looked more confused than ever. Hudson walked them to a car, a station wagon, estate wagon to the Brits, which would at least have ample room for everyone. "Sir John, Jack, that is, well done, and thanks for all your help." "I didn't do shit, Andy, but you handled this pretty damn well," Ryan said, taking his hand. "Come see me in London for a pint sometime." "That I shall do," Hudson promised. The estate wagon was a British Ford. Ryan helped the rabbits into their seats and then took the right front again. "Mr. Lucas, where do we go now?"
"To the airport. Our flight is waiting," the Belgrade COS replied.
"Oh? Special flight?"
"No. The commercial aircraft is experiencing technical difficulties at the moment. I rather expect they will be cleared up about the time we get aboard."
"Good to know," Ryan observed. "Better this than a real broken airplane." Then he realized that one more harrowing adventure lay ahead. His hatred of flying was suddenly back, now that they were in a semi-free country.
"Right, let's be off," Lucas said, starting his engine and pulling off.
Whatever sort of spook Vic Lucas was, he must have thought himself Sterling Moss's smarter brother. The car rocketed down the road into the Yugoslavian darkness.
"So how was your night, Ben Jack?"
"Eventful," Ryan answered, making sure his seatbelt was properly fastened. The countryside here was better lit, and the road better engineered and maintained, or so it seemed, flashing by at what felt like 75 miles per hour, rather fast for a strange road in the dark. Robbie Jackson drove like this, but Robbie was a fighter pilot, and therefore invincible while at the controls of any transportation platform. This Vic Lucas must have felt the same way, calmly looking forward and turning the wheel in short, sharp increments. In the back, Oleg was still tense, and Irina still trying to come to terms with some new and incomprehensible reality, while their little daughter continued to sleep like a diminutive angel. Ryan was chain-smoking. It seemed to help somewhat, though if Kathy smelled it on his breath, there would be hell to pay. Well, she'd just have to understand, Jack thought, watching telephone poles flash by the car like fence pickets. He was doing Uncle Sam's business. Then Ryan saw a police car sitting by the side of the road, its officers sipping coffee or sleeping through their watch.
"Not to worry," Lucas said. "Diplomatic tags. I am the senior political counselor at Her Britannic Majesty's embassy, and you good people are my guests."
"You say so, man. How much longer?"
"Half an hour, roughly. Traffic's been very kind to us so far. Not much truck traffic. This road can be crowded, even late at night, with cross-border trade. That Kovach chap's been working with us for years. I could make quite a good living in partnership with him. He often brings those Hungarian tape machines this way.
They're decent machines, and they're giving the bloody things away. What with the labor costs in Hungary. Surprising they don't try to sell them in the West. Though I expect they'd have to pay the Japanese for the patent infringements. Not too scrupulous about such things on the other side of the line, you see. Lucas took another high-speed turn. Jesus, Guy, how fast do you go in daylight? Not much faster than this. Good night vision, you see. But the suspension on this car slows me down. American design, you see. Too soft for proper handling. So buy a Corvette. Friend of mine has one. Lovely things, but made out of plastic. Lucas shook his head and reached for a cigar. Probably a Cuban one, Ryan was sure. They loved the things in England. Half an hour later, Lucas congratulated himself. There it is, just on time. Airports are airports all over the world. The same architect probably designed them all, Ryan thought. The only differences were the signs for the restrooms. In England, they called them toilets, which had always struck him as a little crude in an otherwise gentle country. Then he got a surprise. Instead of driving to the terminal, Lucas took the path through the open gate right onto the flight line. "I have an arrangement with the airport manager," he explained. "He likes single malts." Still in all, Lucas stayed on the yellow-lined car path, right to a lonely aircraft jetway with an airliner parked next to it. "Here we are," the Brit spook announced. They all stepped out of the car, this time with Mrs. Rabbit holding the bunny. Lucas led them up the exterior stairs into the jetway's control booth, and from there right into the aircraft's open door. The captain, hatless but wearing four stripes on his shoulders, was standing right there. "You're Mr. Lucas?" "That is correct, Captain Rogers. And here are your extra passengers." He pointed to Ryan and the rabbit family. "Excellent." Captain Rogers turned to his lead stew. "We can board the aircraft now." The second-ranking flight attendant took them to the four front-row first-class seats, where Ryan was singularly surprised to be happy belting himself into 1B, the aisle seat just behind the front bulkhead. He watched 30 or so working-class passengers come aboard after sunning themselves on the Dalmatian coast, a favorite for Brits of late, none of them looking very happy for the three-hour delay on what was already supposed to be the day's last flight to Manchester. Things happened quickly after that. He heard both engines start up, and then the BAC-111, the British counterpart to the Douglas DC-9, backed away from the jetway and taxied out on the ramp. "What now?" Oleg asked in what was almost a normal voice. "We fly to England," Ryan replied. 2 hours or so, I guess, and we'll be there." "So easy?" "You think this was easy?" Ryan asked, with no small amount of incredulity in his voice. Then the intercom turned on. "Ladies and gentlemen, this is Captain Rogers speaking. I am glad to say that we finally got the electronic problem repaired. Thank you ever so much for your patience, and after we lift off, the drinks will be free to all passengers." That evoked a cheer from the back of the aircraft. "For the moment, please pay attention to the flight attendants for your safety message. Put your seat belts on, dummies, and they work like this, for those of you stupid enough not to notice that you have the fucking things in your personal automobiles, too." And then in 3 more minutes, the British Midlands airliner clawed its way into the sky. As promised, before they'd gotten to 10,000 feet, the no-smoking light dinged off and the drink cart arrived. The Russian asked for vodka and got 3 miniatures of Finlandia. Ryan got himself a glass of wine and the promise of more. He wouldn't sleep on this flight, but he wouldn't worry as much as usual either. He was leaving the communist world behind at 500 miles per hour, and that was probably the best way to do it. Oleg Ivanich, he saw, drank vodka as though it were water after a hot day of cutting the grass. His wife, over in 1C, was doing the same. Ryan felt positively virtuous, sipping gently at his French wine. "Signal in from Basel," Bostock reported over the phone.
The rabbit is in the air. ETA, Manchester, in 90 minutes.
Great, Judge Moore breathed, relieved as always when a black operation worked out as planned. Better still, they'd run it without Bob Ritter, who, though a good man, was not entirely indispensable.
3 more days and we can debrief him, Bostock said next.
The nice house out by Winchester?
Yeah, we'll see if he likes horse country.
The house even had a Steinway piano for Mrs. Rabbit to play, and lots of green for the kid to run around on.
Alan Kingshott was just pulling into the parking area at the Manchester airport along with 2 subordinates. There would be a large black Daimler automobile to take the arriving defectors out to Somerset in the morning. He hoped they didn't mind driving. It would be nearly a 2-hour drive. For the moment, they'd be quartering at a nice country house just a few minutes from the airport. They'd probably done quite enough traveling for the moment, with still more to come before the end of the week. But then he started thinking about it. Might that be too hard on them? The question gave him something to ponder at one of the airport's bars. Ryan was pretty well potted. Maybe alcohol interacted with anxiety, he thought, taking a moment to go to the forward restroom on the airliner, and feeling better when he got back and was strapped in. He almost never took his seatbelt off. The food served was just sandwiches. English ones with their unnatural affection for a weed called watercress. What he really wanted now was a good corned beef, but the Brits didn't even know what corned beef was, thinking it the canned junk that looked like dog food to most Americans. In fact, the Brits probably fed better stuff to their dogs, as enthralled as they were with their pets. The lights passing underneath the airliner proved that they were overflying Western Europe. The eastern part was never well lit, as he'd learned coming south from Budapest. But Zaitsev wasn't sure. What if this was a very elaborate ruse to get him to spill the beans? What if the second chief directorate had staged a huge Maskirovka village for his brief benefit?
Ryan, Jack turned.
Yes?
What will I see in England when we get there?
I don't know what the plan is after we get to Manchester, Ryan reported.
You are CIA? The rabbit asked again.
Yes, Jack nodded.
How can I be sure of this?
Well, Ryan fished out his wallet.
Here are my driver's license, credit cards, some cash. My passport is fake, of course. I'm an American, but they fixed me up with a British one.
Oh, Ryan realized. You're worried that this is all faked?
How can I be sure?
My friend, in less than an hour, you will be certain it is not. He opened his wallet again.
This is my wife, my daughter, and our new son. My address at home, in America that is here on my driver's license. 5000 Peregrine Cliff Road, Anne Arundel County, Maryland. That is right on the Chesapeake Bay. It takes me about an hour to drive from there to CIA headquarters at Langley. My wife is an eye surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. It is world famous. You must have heard of it.
Zaitsev just shook his head.
Well, a couple of years ago, 3 docs from Hopkins fixed the eyes of Mikhail Suslov. I understand he just died. His replacement, we think, will be Mikhail Yevgenievich Alexandrov. We know a little about him, but not enough. In fact, we don't know enough about Yuri Vladimirovich.
What do you not know?
Is he married? We've never seen a picture of his wife, if any.
Yes, everyone knows this. His wife is Tatiana, elegant woman. My wife says she has noble features.
But no children for them, Oleg concluded.
Well, there's factoid number 1 from the rabbit, Ryan thought.
How is it possible that you do not know this? Zaitsev demanded.
Oleg Ivanich, there are many things we do not know about the Soviet Union, Jack admitted.
Some are important, and some are not.
Is this through?
Yes, it is. Something rattled loose in Zaitsev's head.
You say your name, Ryan?
That's right.
Your father, policeman?
How did you know that? Ryan asked in some surprise.
We have small dossier on you. Washington Residentura do it. Your family attacked by hooligans, yes?
Correct. KGB is interested in me, huh? Jack thought. Terrorists. They tried to kill me and my family. My son was born that night.
And you joined CIA after that?
Again, yes. Officially, anyway. I've done work for the agency for several years.
Then curiosity took full hold. What does my dossier say about me?
It say you are a rich fool. You were officer in naval infantry, and your wife is rich, and you marry her for that reason. To get more money for self.
So, even the KGB is a prisoner of its own political prejudices, Jack thought.
Interesting. I am not poor, Jack told the rabbit, but I married my wife for love, not money. Only a fool does that.
How many capitalists are fools?
Ryan had himself a good laugh. A lot more than you might think. You do not need to be very smart in America to become rich. New York and Washington in particular were full of rich idiots, but Ryan thought the rabbit needed a little while before he learned that lesson.
Who did the dossier on me?
Reporter in Washington Residentura of Izvestia is junior KGB officer. He do it last summer.
And how did you come to know about it?
His dispatch come to my desk, and I forward to America Canada Institute, is KGB office.
You know that, yes?
Yes, Jack confirmed. That is one we do know.
That was when his ears popped. The airliner was descending. Ryan gunned down the last of his third white wine and told himself it would be all over in a few minutes. One thing he'd learned from Operation Beatrix. This field work wasn't for him.
The no-smoking sign dinged back on. Ryan brought his chair to its full upright position, and then the lights of Manchester appeared through the windows, the car headlights and the airport fence, and in a few more seconds, thump, the wheels touched down in merry old England. It might not be the same as America, but for the moment, it would do. Oleg, he saw, had his face against the window, checking out the tail colors of the aircraft. There were too many for this to be a Soviet Air Force base and a huge Maskirovka. He visibly started to relax.
We welcome you to Manchester, the pilot said over the intercom. The time is 3:40 and the temperature outside is 54 degrees Fahrenheit. We appreciate your patience earlier today and we hope to see you again soon in British Midlands Airways.
Yeah, Jack thought. In your dreams, Skipper. Ryan sat and waited as the aircraft taxied to the international arrivals area. A truck-borne stairway came to the front door, which the lead stew duly opened. Ryan and the rabbit family were first off and down the steps, where they were guided to some cars instead of the waiting transfer bus. Alan Kingshot was there to take his hand.
How was it, Jack?
Just like a trip to Disney World, Ryan answered without a trace of audible irony in his voice.
Right. Let's get you all loaded and off to a comfortable place.
Works for me, pal. What is it, 3:15? Ryan hadn't changed his watch back yet. Britain was an hour behind the rest of Europe.
That's right, the field spook confirmed.
Damn, Jack reacted. Too damn late to call home and tell Kathy he was back. But then he wasn't really back. Now he had to play CIA representative for the first interview of the Red Rabbit. Probably Sir Basil had him doing this because he was too junior to be very effective.
Well, maybe he'd show his British host just how dumb he was, Ryan growled to himself. But first, it was time for sleep. Stress, he'd learned, was about as tiring as jogging, just harder on the heart. Back in Budapest, the three bodies were at the city morgue, an institution as depressing behind the Iron Curtain as in front of it. When Zaitsev's identity as a Russian citizen had been confirmed, a call had been made to the Soviet embassy, where it was speedily established that the man in question was a KGB officer. That generated interest in the Residentura, just across the street from the hotel where he'd ostensibly died, and more telephone calls were made. Before 5 in the morning, Professor Zoltan Biraud was awakened in his bed by the AVH. Biraud was professor of pathology at the Ignaz Semmelweis Medical College. Named for one of the fathers of the germ theory that had transformed the science of medicine in the 19th century, it remained a good one, even attracting students from West Germany, none of whom would attend the post-mortem examinations ordered by the country's Belugministerium, which would also be attended by the physician in residence at the Soviet embassy. The first done would be the adult male. Technicians took blood samples from all three bodies for analysis in the adjacent laboratory.
This is the body of a male Caucasian, approximately 35 years of age, length approximately 175 centimeters, weight approximately 76 kilograms. Color of hair cannot be determined due to extensive charring from a domestic fire. Initial impression is death by fire, more probably from carbon monoxide intoxication, as the body shows no evidence of death throes. Then the dissection began with the classical Y incision to open the body cavity for viewing of the internal organs. He was examining the heart, unremarkable, when the lab reports came in.
Professor Biraud, carbon monoxide in all three blood samples are well into lethal range, the voice on the speaker said, giving the exact numbers.
Biraud looked over at his Russian colleague.
Anything else you need? I can do a full post-mortem on all three victims here, but the cause of death is determined. This man was not shot. We will do fuller blood chemistry checks, of course, but it's unlikely that they were poisoned, and there is clearly no bullet wound or other penetrating trauma in this man. They were all killed by fire. I will send you the full laboratory report this afternoon.
Biraud let out a long breath. A kurva elitbe, he concluded with a popular Magyar epithet.
Such a pretty little girl, the Russian internist observed.
Zaitsev's wallet had somehow survived the fire, along with its family photos. The picture of Svetlana had been particularly engaging.
Death is never sentimental, my friend, Biraud told him.
As a pathologist, he knew that fact all too well.
Very well. Thank you, comrade professor.
And the Russian took his leave, already thinking through his official report to Moscow. Chapter 29. Revelation. The safe house was palatial, the country home of somebody with both money and taste, built in the previous century by the look of it, with stucco and the sort of heavy oaken timbers used to build ships like HMS Victory once upon a time. But landlocked, it was about as far from blue water as one could get on this island kingdom. Evidently, Alan Kingshott knew it well enough, since he drove them there and then got them settled inside. The two-person staff that ran the place looked like cops to Ryan, probably married and retired from the police force of the metropolis, as the London Constabulary was officially known. They kindly escorted their new guests to a rather nice suite of rooms. Irina Zaitsev's eyes were agog at the accommodations, which were impressive even by Ryan's standards. All Oleg Ivanovich did was set his shaving kit in the bathroom, strip off his clothes, and collapse onto the bed, where alcohol-aided sleep proved to be less than 5 minutes away.
Word got to Judge Moore just before midnight that the package was safely ensconced in a very secure location, and with that information he also went to bed. All that remained was to tell the Air Force to get a KC-135 or a similar aircraft ready to fly the package home, and that would take a mere telephone call to an officer in the Pentagon. He wondered what the rabbit would say, but he could wait for that. Patience, once the dangerous stuff was behind, was not all that difficult for the Director of Central Intelligence. It was like Christmas Eve, and while he wasn't exactly sure what would be under the tree, he could be confident that it wouldn't be anything bad. For Sir Basil Charleston at his Belgravia house, the news came before breakfast, when a messenger from Century House arrived with the word. An altogether pleasant way to start a working day, he thought, certainly better than some others he'd had. He left home for the office just before 7 a.m., ready for his morning brief to outline the success of Operation Beatrix. Ryan was awakened by traffic noise. Whoever had built this magnificent country home hadn't anticipated the construction of a motorway just 300 yards away, but somehow Ryan had avoided a hangover from all the drinks on the flight in, and the lingering excitement of the moment had gotten him fully awake after a mere 6.5 hours of slumber. He washed up and made his way to the pleasant, not-so-little breakfast room. Alan Kingshott was there, working on his morning tea.
"Probably coffee for you, eh?"
"If you have any." "Only instant," Kingshott warned. Jack stifled his disappointment. "Better than no coffee at all."
"Eggs Benedict?"
the retired woman cop asked. "Ma'am, for that I will forgive the absence of Starbucks," Jack replied with a smile. Then he saw the morning papers and he thought that reality and normality had finally returned to his life. Well, almost. "Mr. and Mrs. Thompson run this house for us," Kingshott explained. "Nick was a homicide detective with the Yard, and Emma was in administration."
"That's what my dad used to do," Ryan observed. "How did you guys get working for SIS?
"Nick worked on the Markov case," Mrs. Thompson answered.
"And did a damn good job of it, too," Kingshott told Ryan. "He would have been a fine field officer for us."
"Bond, James Bond," Nick Thompson said, walking into the kitchen. "I think not. Our guests are moving about. It sounds as though the little girl got them up."
"Yeah," Jack observed. "Kids'll do that."
"So, we do the debrief here or somewhere else?"
"We were planning to do it in Somerset, but I decided last night not to drive them around too much."
"Why stress them out?" Kingshott asked rhetorically. "We just took title to this house last year, and it's as comfortable a place as any. The one in Somerset, near Taunton, is a touch more isolated, but these people ought not to bolt, you think?"
"If he goes home, he's one dead rabbit," Ryan thought out loud. "He has to know that. On the plane, he was worried that we were KGB, and this was all an elaborate maskirovka setup, I think. His wife did a lot of shopping in Budapest. Maybe we have somebody take her shopping around here?" the American wondered.
"Then we can talk to him in comfort. His English seems okay. Do we have anybody here with good Russian?"
"My job," Kingshott told Ryan.
"First thing we want to know, why the hell did he decide to skip town?"
"Obviously. But then what's all this lot about compromised communications?"
"Yeah." Ryan took a deep breath. "I imagine people are jumping out windows about that one."
"Too bloody right," Kingshott confirmed.
"So, Al, you've worked Moscow?"
The Brit nodded.
"Twice. Good sport it was, but rather tense the whole time I was there."
"Where else?"
"Warsaw and Bucharest.
I speak all the languages."
"Tell me, how was Andy Hudson?"
"He's a star, Al. Very smooth and confident all the way. Knows his turf. Good contacts. He took pretty good care of me."
"Here's your coffee, Sir John," Mrs. Thompson said, bringing his cup of taster's choice.
The Brits were good people, and their food, Ryan thought, was wrongly maligned. But they didn't know beans about coffee, and that was that. But it was still better than tea. The Eggs Benedict arrived shortly thereafter, and at that dish, Mrs. Thompson could have given lessons. Ryan opened his paper. It was the Times, and relaxed to get reacquainted with the world. He'd call Kathy in about an hour when he was at work. With luck, he might even see her in a couple days. In a perfect world, he'd have a copy of an American paper, or maybe the International Tribune. But the world was not yet perfect. There was no sense asking how the World Series was going. It was going to start tomorrow, wasn't it? How good were the Phillies this year? Well, as usual, you played the games to find out. So, how was the trip, Jack? Kingshot asked. Alan, those field officers earn every nickel they make. How you deal with the constant tension, I do not understand.
Like everything else, Jack, you get used to it. Your wife is a surgeon. The idea of cutting people open with a knife is not at all appealing to me.
Jack barked a short laugh.
Yeah, me too, pal.
And she does eyeballs. Nothing important, right? Kingshot shuddered visibly at the thought, and Ryan reminded himself that working in Moscow, running agents, and probably arranging rescue missions like they'd done for the rabbit, could not have been much more fun than a heart transplant.
"Ah, Mr. Somerset," Ryan heard Mrs. Thompson say. "Good morning, and welcome."
"Spasibo," Oleg Ivanich replied in a sleepy voice. "Kids could get you up at the goddamnedest hours, with their smiling faces and lovely dispositions."
"That is my new name."
"We'll figure something more permanent later," Ryan told him. "Again, welcome."
"This is England," the rabbit asked.
"We are 8 miles from Manchester," the British intelligence officer replied. "Good morning. In case you don't remember, my name is Alan Kingshot. This is Mrs. Emma Thompson, and Nick will be back in a few minutes." Handshakes were exchanged.
"My wife be here soon. She see the Zaitchik," he explained.
"How are you feeling, Vanya?" Kingshot asked.
"Much travel, much fear. But I am safe now, yes?"
"Yes, you are entirely safe," Kingshot assured him.
"And what would you like for breakfast?" Mrs. Thompson asked.
"Try this," Jack suggested, pointing at his plate. "It's great."
"Yes, I will. What is called?"
"Eggs Benedict," Jack told him. "Mrs. Thompson, this hollandaise sauce is just perfect. My wife needs your recipe, if I may impose. And maybe Kathy could teach her about proper coffee." That would be an equitable trade, Ryan thought.
"Why, certainly, Sir John," she replied with a beaming smile.
No woman in all the world objects to praise for her cooking.
"For me also, then," Zaitsev decided.
"Tea or coffee?" she asked her guest.
"You have English breakfast tea?" the rabbit asked.
"Of course," she answered.
"Please for me, then."
"Certainly."
And she disappeared back into the kitchen. It was still a lot for Zaitsev to take. Here he was, in the breakfast room of a manor house fit for a member of the old nobility, surrounded by a green lawn such as one might see at Augusta National, with monstrous oak trees planted 200 years before, a carriage house and stables in the distance. It was something he might have imagined as worthy of Peter the Great, the things of books and museums, and he was in it as an honored guest. "Nice house, isn't it?" Ryan asked, finishing off the Eggs Benny.
"Is amazing," Zaitsev responded, wide eyes sweeping around.
"Belonged to a ducal family, bought by a textiles manufacturer 100 years ago. But his business fell on hard times, and the government bought it last year. We use it for conferences and as a safe house."
"The heating system is a little primitive," Kingshot reported,
"but that is not a problem at the moment. We've had a very pleasant summer,
and the fall looks promising as well.
At home, there'd be a golf course around this place, Jack said, looking out the windows. A big one.
Yes, Alan agreed. It would be splendid for that.
When I go America, the rabbit asked.
Oh, 3 or 4 days, Kingshot answered. We would like to talk with you a little, if you don't mind.
When do we start?
After breakfast. Take your time, Mr. Zaitsev. You are no longer in the Soviet Union. We shall not pressure you at all, Alan promised.
My ass, Ryan thought. Buddy, they're gonna suck your brain out of your head and strain it for your thoughts one molecule at a time. But the rabbit had just gotten a free ride out of Mother Russia, with the prospect of a comfortable life for him and his family in the West, and everything in life had its price. He loved his tea. Then the rest of the family came out, and over the next 20 minutes, Mrs. Thompson nearly ran out of hollandaise sauce, while the arriving Russians ensured steady employment for the local egg farmers. Irina left the breakfast room to tour the house and was greatly excited to see a concert grand Bösendorfer piano, turning like a kid at Christmas to ask if she might tickle the keys. She was years out of practice, but the look on her face was like a return of childhood as she struggled through On the Bridge at Avignon, which had been her favorite exercise tune many years before, and which she still remembered. A friend of mine plays professionally, Jack said with a smile. It was hard not to appreciate her joy of the moment.
Who?
Where? Oleg asked. Sissy. Actually, Cecilia Jackson. Her husband and I are friends. He's a fighter pilot for the U.S. Navy. She is #2 piano soloist at the Washington Symphony. My wife plays, too, but Sissy is really good.
You are good to us, Oleg Ivanich said.
We try to take decent care of our guests, Kingshot told him.
Shall we talk in the library?
He pointed the way. The chairs were comfortable. The library was another stellar example of 19th-century woodwork, with thousands of books and 3 rolling ladders. It isn't a proper English library without a ladder. The chairs were plush. Mrs. Thompson brought in a tray of ice water and glasses, and business began.
So, Mr. Zaitsev, can you begin to tell us about yourself? Kingshot asked.
He was rewarded by name, ancestry, place of birth, and education.
No military service, Ryan asked.
Zaitsev shook his head.
No. KGB spot me, and they protect me from army time.
And that was in university? Kingshot asked for clarity. A total of 3 tape recorders were turning.
Yes, that is correct. My first year they speak to me for the first time.
And when did you join KGB?
Immediately I leave Moscow State University. They take me into communications department.
And how long there?
Since, well, for 9.5 years in total, set aside my time in academy and other training.
And where do you work now? Kingshot led him on.
I work in central communications in basement of Moscow Center.
And what exactly did you do there? Alan finally asked.
During my watch, all dispatches come in from field to my desk. My job is to maintain security, to be sure proper procedures followed, and then I forward to action officers upstairs, or to United States Canada Institute sometimes, Oleg said, gesturing to Ryan.
Jack did his best not to let his mouth fall open. This guy really was an escapee from the Soviet counterpart to CIA's Mercury. This guy saw it all. Everything, or damn near. He'd just helped a gold mine escape from behind the wire. Son of a bitch.
K
King Shot did a somewhat better job of concealing his feelings, but he let his eyes slip over to Ryan's, and that expression said it all.
Bloody hell.
So, do you know the names of your field officers and their agents? King Shot asked.
KGB officer names. I know many names. Agents, the names I know very few, but I know code names. In Britain, our best agent is codenamed Minister. He give us high-value diplomatic and political intelligence for many years. 20 years, I think. Perhaps more.
You said KGB has compromised our communications, Ryan observed.
Yes, somewhat. That is Agent Neptune. How much he give, I am not sure, but I know KGB read much of American naval communications.
What about other communications? Jack asked immediately.
Naval communications, that I am sure.
Others I am not sure.
But you use same cipher machines for all, yes?
Actually not, Alan told him.
So, you say British communications are secure?
If broken, I do not know it, Zaitsev replied.
Most American diplomatic and intelligence information we get come from Agent Cassius. He is aide to senior politician in Washington. He give us good information on what CIA do and what CIA learn from us.
But you said he's not part of CIA, Ryan asked.
No. I think he is politician aide, helper, member of staff,
like that, Zaitsev said, rather positively.
Good.
Ryan lit up a smoke and offered one to Zaitsev, who took it at once.
I run out of my Krasnoprezhensky, he explained.
I should give you all of mine.
My wife wants me to quit. She's a doctor, Jack explained.
Bah, the rabbit responded.
So, why did you decide to leave? King Shot asked, taking a sip of tea. The reply nearly made him drop the cup.
KGB wanted to kill Pope.
You're serious?
It was the more experienced man who asked that question, not Ryan.
Serious? I risk my life. My wife, life, my daughter, life. Da, I am serious, Oleg Ivanovich assured his interlocutors with an edge on his voice.
Fuck, Ryan breathed.
Oleg, we need to know about this. It start in August. 15 August it start, Zaitsev told them, spinning out his tale without interruption for 5 or 6 minutes.
No name for the operation? Jack asked when he stopped.
No name. Just dispatch number 15882666. That is date of first message from Andropov to Resident Yura, Rome, and number of message, yes? Yuri Vladimirovich ask, how get close to Pope? Rome say bad idea. Then Colonel Rozhdestvensky, he is main assistant to chairman, yes? He send signal to Resident Yura Sofia. Operation go from Sofia. So, Operation 666 probably run for KGB by Dirzhavna Sugranost. I think officer name is Strokov, Boris Andreevich.
King Shot had a thought and rose, leaving the room. He came back with Nick Thompson, a former detective superintendent of the Metropolitan Police.
Nick, does the name Boris Andreevich Strokov mean anything to you?
The former cop blinked hard.
Indeed it does, Alan. He's the chappie we think killed Georgi Markov on Westminster Bridge. We had him under surveillance, but he flew out of the country before we had enough cause to pick him up for questioning.
Wasn't he under diplomatic cover? Ryan asked, and was surprised by Thompson's answer.
Actually not. He came in undocumented and left the same way. I saw him myself at Heathrow, but we didn't put the pieces together quickly enough.
dreadful case it was. The poison they gave Markov was horrific stuff.
You eyeballed the Strokov guy?
Thompson nodded.
Oh, yes.
He might have noticed me. I wasn't being all that careful under the circumstances. He's the one who killed Markov. I'd stake my life on it.
How can you be sure?
I chased murderers for near on 20 years, Sir John. You get to know them in all that time.
And that's what he was. A murderer, Thompson said with total confidence.
Ryan could remember his father being like this, even on frustrating cases when he knew what he needed but couldn't quite prove it to a jury.
The Bulgarians have a sort of contract with the Soviets, Kingshot explained. Back in 1964 or so, they agreed to handle all the necessary eliminations for the KGB. In return, they get various perks, mostly political.
Strokov, yes, I've heard that name before.
Did you get a photo of the chap, Nick?
50 or more, Alan, Thompson assured him. I'll never forget that face. He has the eyes of a corpse. No life in them at all. Like a doll's eyes.
How good is he? Ryan asked.
As an assassin?
Quite good, Sir John.
Very good indeed. His elimination of Markov on the bridge was expertly done. It was the third attempt. The first two would-be assassins bungled the job, and they called Strokov in to get it right.
And that he did.
Had things gone just a little differently, we would not have realized it was a murder at all.
We think he's worked elsewhere in the West, Kingshot said. But very little good information.
Just gossip, really.
Jack, this is a dangerous development. I need to get this information to Basil, soonest.
And with that, Alan left the room to get to a secure phone.
Ryan turned back to Zaitsev.
And that's why you decided to leave?
KGB won't kill innocent men, Ryan.
I see plot grow. And the Ropov himself say, do this. I handle the messages.
How can man stop KGB, he asked.
I cannot stop KGB, but I will not help KGB kill priest.
He is an innocent man, yes?
Ryan's eyes looked down at the floor.
Yes, Oleg Ivanovich, he is.
Dear God in heaven.
He checked his watch.
He had to get this information out PDQ, but nobody was awake at Langley yet.
Bloody hell, Sir Basil Charleston said into his secure phone. Is this reliable information, Alan?
Yes, sir, I believe it to be entirely truthful.
Our rabbit seems a decent chap and a rather clever one. He seems to be motivated exclusively by his conscience.
Next, Kingshot told him about the first revelation of the morning. Minister.
We need to get 5 looking into that.
The British Security Service, once known as MI5, was the counter-espionage arm of their government. They'd need a little more specific information to run that putative traitor down, but they already had a starting point.
20 years, was it?
What a productive traitor that fellow had to be, Sir Basil thought. Time for him to see Parkhurst Prison on the Isle of Wight. Charleston had spent years cleaning up his own shop, once a playground for the KGB. But no more, and never bloody again, the knight commander of the Bath swore to himself.
Ryan wondered. Basil would doubtless call Langley. Jack would make sure of that, but Sir Basil was a supremely reliable guy.
Next came a more difficult question.
What the hell can we do about this?
Ryan lit another smoke to consider that one. It was more police work than intelligence work.
And the central issue would be classification.
Yeah, that's going to be the problem. If we tell anybody, the word will get out somehow, and then somebody will know we have the rabbit.
And guess what, Jack?
The rabbit is now more important to the CIA than the life of the Pope. Oh, shit, Ryan thought. It was like a trick of jiu-jitsu, like a sudden reversal of polarity on the dial of a compass. North was now south. Inside was now outside. And the needs of American intelligence might now supersede the life of the Bishop of Rome. His face must have betrayed what he was thinking.
"What is amiss, Ryan?" the rabbit asked.
It seemed to Jack a strange word for him to know.
"The information you just gave us.
We've been worrying about the safety of the Pope for a couple of months, but we had no specific information to make us believe his life was actually at risk. Now you have given that information to us, and someone must decide what to do with it. Do you know anything at all about the operation?"
"No, almost nothing. In Sofia, the action officer is the resident, Colonel Bubovoy, Ilya Fedorovich. Senior colonel, he is. Ambassador, can I say? To Bulgarian DS. This Colonel Strokov, this name I know from old cases. He is officer assassin for DS. He do other things too, yes, but when men need bullet, Strokov deliver bullet, yes?"
This struck Ryan as something from a bad movie, except that in the movies, the big bad CIA was the one with a special assassination department, like a cupboard with vampire bats inside. When the director needed somebody killed, he'd open the door, and one of the bats flew out and made its kill, then flew back docilely to the cupboard and hung upside down until the next man needed killing.
"Sure, Wilbur.
Hollywood had everything figured out except that government bureaucracies all ran on paper. Nothing happened without a written order of some sort, because only a piece of white paper with black ink on it would cover somebody's ass when things went bad. And if somebody really needed killing, someone inside the system had to sign the order. And who would sign that kind of order? That sort of thing became a permanent record of something bad, and so the signature blank would be bucked all the way to the Oval Office. And once there, it just wasn't the sort of paper that would find its way into the presidential library that memorialized the person known inside the security community as National Command Authority. And nobody in between would sign the order, because government employees never stuck their necks out. That wasn't the way they were trained.
Except me, Ryan thought. But he wouldn't kill someone in cold blood.
He hadn't even killed Sean Miller in very hot blood, and while that was a strange thing to be proud of, it beat the hell out of the alternative. But Jack wasn't afraid of sticking it out. The loss of his government paycheck would be a net profit for John Patrick Ryan. He could go back to teaching, perhaps at a nice private university that paid halfway decently, and he'd be able to dabble with the stock market on the side, something with which his current job interfered rather badly. What the hell am I going to do? The worst part of all was that Ryan considered himself to be a Catholic. Maybe he didn't make it to Mass every week. Maybe they'd never name a church after him, but goddammit, the Pope was someone he was compelled by his lengthy education. Catholic schools all the way, including almost 12 years of Jesuits, to respect. And added to that was something equally important. The education he'd received at the gentle hands of the United States Marine Corps at Quantico's basic school. They'd taught him that when you saw something that needed doing, you damn well did it. And you hoped that your senior officers would bless it afterward, because decisive action had saved the day more than once in the history of the Corps. It's a lot easier to get forgiveness than permission, was what the major who'd taught that particular class had said, then added with a smile, "But don't you people ever quote me on that." You just had to apply judgment to your action, and such judgment came with experience. But experience often came from bad decisions.
You're over 30 now, Jack, and you've had experience that you never wanted to get. But be damned if you haven't learned a hell of a lot from it. He would have been at least a captain by now, Jack thought. Maybe even a junior major, like Billy Tucker, who'd taught that class.